Declaring Ebola an international public health emergency shows how seriously the World Health Organization is taking the current outbreak, but statements won't save lives. Now we need this statement to translate into immediate action on the ground. A massive medical, epidemiological, and public health response is desperately needed to save lives and reverse the course of the epidemic. Lives are being lost because the response is too slow. That's a statement by Dr. Bart Janssens, Director of Operations for Doctors Without Borders. How worried should we be not only about the Ebola virus, but about the hundreds of other infectious diseases springing up everywhere, from Africa to right here in our backyards in Wisconsin? I'm Emily Auerbach, and this is University of the Air. We hear the term Ebola every day in the news, but what are the facts behind this epidemic? What is the status of other viruses that made headlines in the past, such as SARS, mad cow disease, and the hantavirus? Can diseases we thought we were safe from, such as tuberculosis and polio, reappear? How much should we worry here in Wisconsin about mosquito-borne diseases such as West Nile and chikungunya fever? Joining me to talk about emerging infectious diseases of the 21st century is expert Dr. Dennis Mackey, Ovid Meyer Professor of Medicine and attending physician at the Center for Trauma and Life Support at the UW Hospital. Welcome back to University of the Air.
Thank you very much.
I bet you're in high demand right now with all the news about the Ebola virus.
I think every infectious disease specialist in the country is getting countless questions, queries, not only from patients, but from colleagues, from friends. My own son, who's a radiologist, is getting numerous queries, and he certainly is not an expert in the field.
Yeah.
There's a good example of an international disease that doesn't impact on us immediately at the present time, but which has gained traction and the attention of the entire world because of the potential threat it can pose.
And that gives us a chance to kind of step back from the daily news and look at the broader picture. And I wonder if we could start by talking about what do you count as an infectious disease and what's the scope of this problem? It seems as if just about every week there's a new headline, you know, or we'll take a little break from one scary thing and then another appears. Give us some sense of what is an infectious disease and how many diseases are we talking about and why are new ones coming up?
Well, what we're really talking about here is what are called emerging infectious diseases. Infectious diseases, in sum, are a microorganism invades an individual and establishes itself perhaps in the respiratory tract or the gastrointestinal tract or on the skin, and it may or may not cause clinical illness, but it causes an infection. It's multiplying and growing and can be transmitted.
And that can be both bacterial and viral?
And it could be bacterial, viral, fungal. And if we talk about mad cow disease, we're talking about prions, which are really a unique class of infectious agents, entirely different from anything that we've previously seen. Emerging infectious diseases is a relatively new field that's only been termed as such about 25 years ago. 25 to 30 years ago, we had the appearance of a couple of new infectious diseases after it had been thought that all of the human infections had been identified and characterized. When I entered the field about 40 years ago, there hadn't been much new in terms of new infectious pathogens in humans for many years. And in the mid-1970s, we had an outbreak of pneumonia in legionnaires who went to a convention, which was discovered to be caused by an entirely newly discovered bacterium that was in our water supply, something that most people probably have showered in the last week, but does not cause illness in the majority of individuals who are exposed. In any event, that was quite sobering, and it really gained the attention of infectious disease and public health officials. This was followed very shortly thereafter by an outbreak of shock in healthy young people, young women, related to hyperabsorbent tampons, an old established pathogen, Staph aureus. It causes skin and other infections, but here was a supertoxigenic strain that had a gene to produce a powerful toxin that made people critically ill and could be fatal. That really got people's eyes open and the attention that maybe there's more out there. Well, it came pell-mell thereafter. Pretty soon we had strep toxic shock syndrome. Then HIV came, And then we had Lyme disease and anaplasma and mad cow disease, and it's gone on and on. And there's about 75 pathogens or illnesses that have been defined in the last 25 to 30 years that didn't exist when I was training 40 years ago. They were not known. They were not defined. They've all occurred in the last three decades.
Now, is that, do you think the fact that we're finding so many, is that we're better at finding them? Or is that, is it something that we're doing that's actually, like, for example, using so many antibiotics or some other condition that's actually creating a situation that's ripe for the...
Well, the fascinating thing about it is it's a little of both. I think it's very clear our capacities to identify new microorganisms has literally exploded in the last two decades. The whole field of molecular diagnostics has basically subsumed the old techniques of culture plates in a laboratory and trying to culture viruses and tissue culture, being able to detect the actual genome of the organism, the DNA or the RNA of the organism, or to detect a molecule on the organism called an antigen by sensitive techniques is just revolutionizing diagnostics in infectious disease. What's so exciting about it is that it's allowed us to make very rapid diagnosis. These molecular techniques can be done in hours. The old techniques could take as long as 6 weeks for diagnosis of tuberculosis. And now we can know almost instantly if a person has a serious infection. And these techniques are becoming very widely available. Obviously, not every hospital has the capacity of doing all of the tests, but reference labs are usually within a half a day's journey, literally hours journey by sending specimens by airplane. And as a consequence, you can have a rapid diagnosis of the rarest disease in a day or two, whereas previously it could have been many weeks or even months. And we're using these tests now on a routine basis very widely in the field of infectious diseases and clinical medicine. So we can recognize these pathogens much earlier. When we see a syndrome, a new type of an illness in a group of individuals that doesn't fit anything else, the standard tests are all negative, we can actually go fishing with molecular techniques. Is there a new microbial DNA or RNA present in specimens from the infected individual, and find, my goodness, this is a new disease. This is a new virus. A very good example of that would be the Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, or the MERS, which is a SARS-like virus which appeared in Saudi Arabia and has spread into the Middle East and is a very serious threat, because it's a very virulent virus and has about a 50 to 60% mortality in healthy people. And that was detected very, very quickly because we had the capacity to identify new viruses by molecular techniques. So that's number one. But number two, about three quarters of the emerging infectious diseases that have been defined and characterized very well in the last three decades are what we term zoonoses. They infect animals. And in fact, the majority of them, the infectious agent, will live in an animal and often cause little or no disease. Sometimes it'll kill the animal. Often the animal only carries the organism.
Would that be like the swine flu, the bird flu, the monkeypox?
Monkeypox is a good example. But it turns out if we look at Lyme disease is a bacterium that actually winters over in mice. Deer play a role in perpetuating the organism, and the infected tick, we just happen to be in the way. The organism probably is better termed, it's would probably rather live in a mouse or a deer, but if we're in the way, we'll serve just fine for the needs of the organism. Well, this applies for a large proportion of these new infectious diseases or zoonoses. The MERS that we just talked about, the Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, is looking very much like bats are the source of the virus. They may have infected camels, and that may have been a mechanism it got to humans in the Middle East, where there's plenty of camels, and people actually eat camel meat, and they drink camel milk. The SARS virus, which was a serious global threat only a decade ago, primarily in Asia, but there was an outbreak in Canada, has been shown to be a zoonosis. And again, there are rodents that carry the virus, bats probably play a role in perpetuating the virus. And the Ebola virus, which is in the news today, it's pretty clear that the reservoir of the virus is bats, probably fruit bats, throughout Africa, and that humans and other animals become infected when they acquire the virus from bats. The bats' droppings drop onto fruit, and potentially an animal can get infected, such as a gorilla or chimpanzee or a deer. And if humans eat the infected animal, there's a high likelihood they're going to get sick. And humans may even get it directly from eating vegetables or fruit that have been contaminated by bat droppings.
And why, as we turn to the Ebola virus, if there's a link to animals, why would it be more of a problem now than 5 years ago? Or, you know, in other words, sometimes when something sort of rears its head and suddenly becomes epidemic level, and we've seen the images of people in these suits that look like they're astronauts and just widespread panic, really, dead bodies left in the street because people are afraid to touch them and so on. Why does something suddenly get out of control if there hasn't been a change in anything else?
Let me take Lyme disease or anaplasmosis, which are important tick-borne infections in the upper Midwest, certainly in Wisconsin, and answer that question. There's evidence that Lyme disease was occurring in Wisconsin going back almost 60 years. People had the illness, but the organism was unknown. The diagnostic tests were not available. But astute physicians realized there was something out there, and they found that if they treated their patient with tetracycline, they often got better more rapidly. It turns out that the organism probably is, there's probably more infected ticks out in the wild in Wisconsin today than there were 50 or 60 years ago. As we evolve as a society, probably the most striking changes are the great increase in population and the move to urbanization. But the urbanization often encroaches on areas. People want to live in the country. They want to live near wooded areas. People want to spend time in wooded areas, and the wooded areas and the wild areas are shrinking. The predators have pretty much been killed. There are very few predators that, although we've brought wolves back to Wisconsin for 50 or 60 years, there were virtually no wolves in the state, and the deer populations went out of sight. There's far more white-tailed deer in Wisconsin now than there were 100 years ago. And the predators also are not around. The weasels and other things that would keep the mouse populations down, the hawks, the eagles, they're down. And as a consequence, there are a lot of infected mice. There are, if you go to areas of northwestern Wisconsin, as many as 30 to 40% of the ticks carry the Lyme organism or anaplasma, which is a related organism that makes people sicker than you get with Lyme disease. In any event, the changes in our society have resulted in the capacity for us to be exposed to these zoonoses much more than in the past. We also have, to use the old cliche, the world is shrinking. We talk about international travel. It's enormous. I mean, probably 75 million people travel internationally on an ongoing basis and develop illness while they travel each year. There's enormous amount of international travel. So exotic diseases that may have been isolated to a certain geographic locale can be spread very widely, and there's a capacity for global spread.
What about through trade, like food and other things?
Well, we obtain a great deal of our food now internationally, and you're absolutely right. There have been outbreaks of unusual parasitic infections in the United States from food that was obtained internationally, contaminated by unusual parasites that have never been seen previously in North America, so that trade is a mechanism. I mean, we want to look at an impact of trade on our ecology, bringing in pine beetles that have killed billions and billions of trees in the West and Northwest and throughout Alaska is an example of the impact of greatly increased trade.
So when we see a disease break out in a region that's torn apart by war or by starvation and other kinds of factors, are the environmental conditions, the sort of horrible situation on the ground, helping to foster then disease, outbreaks of disease?
Whenever one has social disruption on a major scale, whether it's due to war, such as in parts of Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, where there's millions and millions of individuals in camps, literally, and it's tragic. They're under terrible hygienic conditions, crowded, they're malnourished, they're very vulnerable to infectious disease. It's a model for the spread of infectious disease. And thousands of children are dying each day of childhood diarrhea, measles, meningococcal disease, tuberculosis because of this situation. Part of the problem in Africa, why we're seeing things like Marburg virus, which is a cousin of Ebola. We've known about that for 30 to 40 years, and now we have Ebola. Very resistant forms of tuberculosis coming out of Africa is Africa's urbanizing. And as a consequence, these isolated villages, you could have an outbreak of Ebola in a little village. If nobody ever left the village, a lot of people got sick and died, but it never spread. Now there's much, much more communication between villages. People in the villages go into the big cities to work. There's long trucking lanes throughout Africa. So there's ample opportunity for spread of infectious agents very widely throughout Africa. And the tragedy of Africa is the lack of public health facilities and particularly resources. Immunization is still suboptimal, and the capacity to respond to an outbreak is very, very limited. It behooves the West, the wealthy countries of the world that have been blessed, to step up and to help on a major scale, because if they don't, nothing's going to happen, and it's going to just simply continue to spread unabated. And we're going to go from thousands to tens of thousands to hundreds of thousands to potentially to millions. That may seem extreme, but the risk is there. And I think that this is by far the largest Ebola outbreak we've had, and there are no signs whatsoever it's abating. What's even more concerning, the outbreak has now gotten to the large cities, such as Moravia and Liberia and such as Lagos in Nigeria. Those are huge, huge cities. They're enormous amount of crowding, and the capacity for rapid spread is great. And so that the problem is here, and we have to respond now. We don't have a lot of time because it could literally come out of control. The West is concerned, obviously, is it going to spread to their countries and is it going to pose a threat to their people? That's a legitimate concern, and that's understandable. Every country is concerned about the well-being of itself. That's our first concern. But I think we have a moral obligation to help these countries that are in such desperate situation. And I'm heartened by WHO's decision yesterday to term it an international emergency. I think that'll bring a lot more resources to bear.
I saw that the World Health Organization spokesperson said that one of the biggest problems right now is fear and misinformation, that bogus reports and sort of falsified information, myths, misconceptions are leading the people in Africa to do things that are actually making the situation worse. What are the biggest misconceptions that people have about Ebola?
Well, the part of the problem in public health control in Africa is that you have enormous populations that have limited scientific education. They don't understand about microorganisms, contagion, simple things we take for granted are mysterious. And it's unknown. All they know is that if their family member is taken away to a hospital, they usually die. And if they die, they make that association with the hospital. The hospital is why they died. And who is somebody from the outside to come in and tell them how they should prepare the body of their loved one? They've done this for hundreds of years. They want to wash it, and they want to lovingly bury the person. And by doing so, they put all the people involved at great risk. They don't understand that, but this is not even misinformation. It's the challenge of being able to try to bring basic public health to an entirely different culture. There are huge cultural gaps is the problem. Many of the aid workers, the villages, either they drive them away or the people run and hide. They don't want to participate. They're frightened that the AIDS workers can even bring the disease. And it poses formidable barriers to simple public health measures that can reduce risk. So the challenges are really substantial in Africa, I can say. We not only need a lot of people on the ground and resources, but it won't be easy even if we have that because of these barriers.
More on infectious diseases of the 21st century when we continue in a moment with the University of the Air. Ebola hemorrhagic fever, Ebola HF, is one of the numerous viral hemorrhagic fevers. It is a severe, often fatal disease in humans and non-human primates, such as monkeys, gorillas, and chimpanzees. That's from the website of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Dennis Mackey, and we are talking about emerging infectious diseases of the 21st century. Certainly, Ebola is only one of many, many diseases that we would like to talk about, but it's the one most in the news. Is that what keeps you up at night? You know, you're an expert on infectious disease. You know more than most of us do about what can happen both locally and globally. What keeps you up at night worrying?
Well, I don't lose a lot of sleep thinking about uncontrolled spread of Ebola in the United States or North America because, first of all, I think it's almost inevitable we will have introduced Ebola in the United States. When we consider probably 500 to 1,000 people a day get off an airplane from Africa, it's hard for me to believe we're not going to have introduced cases of Ebola. But I don't think we'd see anything close to what's happening in Africa because I think our capacity to respond to something like this is infinitely better. Let me tell you what we do at University. What if it happened in Madison?
Mm-hmm.
We've thought about emerging infectious diseases for a long time at University Hospitals. More than 10 years ago, we put together a detailed response plan for emerging infectious diseases. We have one whole 35-bed unit that we have retrofitted to have a separate air supply. So it's completely airborne isolation in this unit. None of the air in that unit circulates elsewhere in the hospital. Now, that's just a general medical unit right now. If we suddenly had 3 or 4 cases of Ebola or Middle Eastern respiratory syndrome, or we suddenly had a flu epidemic of a very virulent contagious strain, we could move the current patients off that unit within probably 6 hours. We could set it up as a special sealed isolation unit. The individuals who would be working in that unit are trained, know exactly what we'd do, and the patients would be cared for in that unit. That unit has the capacity of establishing a whole new freestanding ICU. We could place patients on ventilators and treat any kind of a medical problem in that unit without ever leaving that unit. And there's a very high level of security in terms of reducing spread. We have special suits, number one. There's hazmat-like suits. But we have special rooms. We have rooms that are totally sealed, literally. They have their own air supply, and the whole unit has its own air supply. So it's a double form of protection against spread of anything that's transmitted through the air, which is our biggest concern.
Like at Emory University, is it sort of similar
exactly.
to
it's
that?
Very similar to that exactly. I feel confident we could provide a very, very high level of protection. The second thing that would happen if there was a case is the public health authorities would go into high gear and they'd want to identify every person who had had contact with that person over the preceding 2 to 3 weeks. Because the incubation period of Ebola is about 7 to 9 days on average, but rarely can be as long as 2 to 3 weeks. But that's very unusual.
Isn't that impossible? I mean, if I think of how many people I've had contact, let's say I show up with Ebola. If I think of all the people that I've had contact with over the last 2 to 3 weeks, that's so many people in so many places.
Well, the interesting thing is that I'll bet we could, if we sat down with you and really went through it carefully, who you had close face-to-face contact with, not a room full of people, face-to-face contact, particularly shook hands with them or very close to them, I bet you could remember who it was in the last 10 days. I bet if you really put your mind to it, you could do that.
And
those individuals would be immediately screened, mm-hmm. and they would be possibly, if they had the slightest sign of illness, they'd be put in quarantine under observation. And that's the key to preventing secondary spread.
And so the handshaking, I know there was a while where everyone switched to fist bumps, you know.
Yep,
I forget
yep.
what we were afraid of then. What was that one? It was at the
swine flu
or yeah. whatever it was. But
yeah.
does it really make that much difference to do a fist bump as opposed to a handshake?
Well, there's far fewer contagious organisms on the outside of your hand and outside of your fingers than there are on the inside where mm-hmm. you touch. You touch on the inside of your hand. So a fist bump does transmit far fewer organisms than does actually shaking hands.
What about the don't touch the walls thing that they have been talking
about?
Well,
don't touch the walls is in some of these countries like Kenema, New Guinea, Guinea, or in Sierra Leone. These hospitals have had huge numbers of individuals with Ebola. Some of them are totally empty. The people have died, and the natives who have disease refuse to come back to these hospitals. And there's fear that these hospitals surfaces are massively contaminated with the Ebola virus. We don't know that with certainty. It's assumed that's the case, but we don't know that with certainty. There's been little evidence in the studies that have been done to suggest that the inanimate environment plays a major role in spread. I think that the vast majority of transmissions occur with physical contact or being very, very close. If a person coughs or sneezes on you, or you have contact with their saliva, or you clean up their blood, that's where the risk is. Distance spread by the air, there's never been much evidence that occurs. I think that there is airborne spread within a distance of 2 or 3 feet. That's called droplet nuclei spread. But it's not nearly as contagious as, say, tuberculosis or certainly influenza. Influenza is highly contagious if you have a new strain, and that can be spread more distantly probably than the Ebola virus. But the bottom line is that understanding the epidemiology of an infectious agent, exactly how it's spread, what are the circumstances that allow it to be spread and transmitted, are fundamental to establishing control measures that are rational and effective. You can't put a hazmat suit on for everybody, and you don't need to. A good example is tuberculosis. Tuberculosis is only spread through the air. There's no risk of spread of tuberculosis by shaking hands with somebody who has active TB or physical contact. On the other hand, if you're breathing the same air in the same room and they're coughing, then you are at substantial jeopardy, which is why high-quality masks and sealed air-controlled rooms, isolation rooms, are fundamental to control spread of TB. But we don't use hazmat suits for tuberculosis, even multi-drug-resistant tuberculosis. On the other hand, agents such as influenza, which can be spread both by contact as well as by droplet nuclei in the air that come out of their respiratory tract, we do use maximal barriers. We use gowns, gloves, and particularly high-quality masks.
So what does keep you awake at night then, if it's not worrying about Ebola, because it seems as if we would know what to do to sort of prevent it?
I'll tell you what I think about at night when it's dark is one of these strains of influenza that are circulating right now in China and in Asia. There are two strains of influenza, H5N1, H7N9. Those are just terms for strains of influenza A. These viral strains have about a 60% mortality in healthy young people.
That's terrible.
They're not highly contagious. They can spread person to person, but they don't spread very efficiently person to person. There's been very little. Most of the individuals who've gotten infected have had contact with infected birds, food birds. These viruses can infect birds very readily. In any event, if one of those strains acquired a gene, the kind of work that Professor Kawaka does on our campus, to identify a gene that allows rapid transmission human to human, and one of these strains started to spread, we could have a global epidemic with the strain that would make any prior historical epidemic pale in comparison. Remember, in the 14th century, plague mm-hmm. killed one-third of the population of Europe.
And remind me,
that was a bacterial.
The plague
bacillus, a bacterium bacillus, and it was transmitted by contact in the airborne route, people coughing in direct contact. And rats and fleas, people would get bitten by fleas from rats, and they basically got infected. That was another mechanism of spread, infected rats. In any event, if we look at the most recent global pandemic that killed tens of millions of people, it's been estimated 100 million people died in the 1918 influenza epidemic. That was a horrible pandemic, and that literally shut down societies around the world. Literally, schools were closed, businesses closed down for a period of months. Literally, everything ground to a halt. A lot of people thought it was the end of the world because everybody was vulnerable to this strain, and a lot of people got terribly sick, and many, many people died. A lot of young people died particularly. Well, if I step back and look at 19, what percentage of people who got that strain, got influenza, that strain, died? It was, the worst was about 2%. Now, that was terrible. Mm-hmm. Currently, the strains of flu that we've dealt with in our lifetime have killed far less than one in every 1,000 to 5,000 people, been far, far less virulent. 1918 killed 2%, so 100 million people died around the world. If we had a strain such as we that are circulating in China right now and other parts of Asia, H5N1 or H7N9, and they suddenly acquired the capacity to spread efficiently person to person, we could have a global pandemic that would make everything else pale in significance. It'd be devastating. That's something I think about and I worry about, mm-hmm. and why I feel somewhat relieved that we have a very good influenza surveillance system globally, initiated initially by CDC, now supported by WHO. Many of the countries of the world that have influenza labs, we're looking for new strains of influenza on an ongoing basis. So if one of these strains appeared and started to spread rapidly, I feel confident we detect it pretty rapidly.
I think one of the things that's so scary about infectious diseases is that they are invisible. So there's this feeling, you know, you can't see your enemy, and it could be the person sitting next to you on the plane that just coughed on you. It could be the food you're eating, you know, the animal that runs over your feet. It's that feeling, I guess, that enemies are everywhere that can attack, and you don't want to go around in a glass bubble. You can't.
See, the good news for most of the emerging infectious diseases, they're intellectually fascinating. They can be very frightening. When you realize there's these new infectious agents out here, the vast majority of them that we deal with on an ongoing basis, we have treatment for. We understand well, we know how to prevent spread, and we have treatment for a large proportion of them. Not all of them, but the majority of them, we can do something pretty significant for a person who's infected. We can diagnose it quickly in the vast majority of these diseases. So we've made a lot of progress in my lifetime. In this field over the past 40 years, I step back and I'm just amazed by how much we have moved ahead in our abilities to diagnose infectious diseases, but especially to treat them mm-hmm. and to contain spread by public health measures. When I went into the field of infectious diseases 40 years ago, there were probably not more than a dozen vaccines. We now have 60 or 70 vaccines. We've eliminated polio in my lifetime. There hasn't been a case of wild-type polio in North America for 30 years.
Does it worry you when you hear polio back in the news or in other places?
Well, I do. I'm glad you raised that because I'm very concerned. I think all of us in infectious disease and public health are very concerned about the capacity of polio to return because too many people in North America are becoming negatively inclined towards vaccines. They're suspicious of vaccines. They're not having their children immunized. They're not serving anybody well because if the outbreak comes because the level of immunity in the population declines significantly, we can have return of these diseases.
Let me ask you, what would you say to a parent who's listening right now who has chosen not to do the immunizations because they've heard on the internet celebrities talking, autism worries, this thing and that thing, so they'll think, well, I'm just not going to have my child have any immunizations,
well,
not let, measles,
let,
not mumps.
Let me put it this way. You're worried about autism. You've read on the internet that measles vaccine can cause autism. That's been examined exhaustively. And to me, the ultimate test, do the people who are promoting vaccines, do they really believe it, or is this all a scheme? We all immunize our children. I wouldn't dream of not immunizing my children. I know nobody who works in this field who is not field literally rabid about immunizing their children and their family, because they have no concern whatsoever about the issue of autism or that the vaccines are going to cause terrible long-term consequences. But there's enormous benefit to be gained by immunizing your children. And by immunizing my children, I'm providing some protection for the entire society. If my children are immune, they're less likely to acquire infections that can go to the kids who are not immunized. So the higher the levels of immunization in a society, the less likely you're going to have epidemic spread of any infectious agent. A good example of where we see politics interfering with public health is what's happening in parts of Nigeria and in Pakistan. Fundamentalist Islamic mullahs are opposing immunization. They somehow feel this is a scheme on the part of the West, and so they're killing immunization workers. It's terrible. And polio is coming back. They're seeing epidemic polio, children getting paralytic polio unnecessarily. This is just a tragedy, but we live in a less than perfect world, unfortunately.
That's for sure. More on infectious disease when we continue in a moment with University of the Air. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Dr. Dennis Mackey, and we are talking about emerging infectious diseases of the 21st century. Let's take it home here to Wisconsin, because especially with a lot of us getting in that last camping trip or wanting to go hiking in the woods and so on, tell us about the mosquito-borne illnesses, the ones that are the most concerning, and also what we could do about it.
That's a very good question, because we sort of think of mosquitoes as sort of an annoyance, and we may or may not take active measures to minimize our risk of exposure to mosquitoes. But I would like to make the case that we ought to pay much greater attention to minimizing mosquito exposure. The mosquito-borne infection in Wisconsin that's been the greatest threat over the last 7 or 8 years has been West Nile virus. West Nile virus only appeared about a little over a decade ago. It was introduced into New York City area, and in the space of 3 years, it spread to all 48 continental states. And West Nile virus is a virus that's been around in Africa it's been recognized for almost 100 years. It causes a lot of febrile illness, fever in children in Africa. Why West Nile virus is important is that in older individuals, in individuals who are immunocompromised for any reason, such as cancer therapy, transplants, HIV infection, West Nile can be devastating. It can be fatal. It can leave people paralyzed. It causes a meningoencephalitis. It can be a devastating infection. So as I get older, I just don't want to get West Nile virus because I know I'm old enough so that if I get West Nile virus, there's a good likelihood I could get quite ill. It could even incapacitate me. There's two new viruses that are now spreading rapidly across the United States, I think, are examples of global warming, seen with global warming. One is dengue, which is a virus that causes fever and severe pain in the muscles and bones in tropical parts of the world. It's endemic in the Caribbean and South and Central America. It's endemic in parts of Asia and Africa, and occasionally can be life-threatening. Most of the time, people just get very sick with fever, and they're sick for a week or two. But there's a new one. It's got a rather unusual name called chikungunya fever. And chikungunya has been recognized as a cause of a febrile illness where the person gets a fever, gets a headache, but they get severe arthritis. They get all their joints become inflamed and very painful. And they're going to be pretty sick and almost incapacitated by discomfort for a matter of several weeks to possibly a month or two.
And I should maybe mention that when I first heard about chikungunya, I thought it was chicken, you know, poultry.
Right.
Then I see the spelling, the C-H-I-K-U-N, gunya, chikungunya. So it has no relationship
Nothing
to chicken.
Nothing to do with birds. It turns out that chikungunya is spreading particularly rapidly across the United States right now. There have been hundreds of cases identified. The closest to Wisconsin thus far has been in southern Illinois, but I'm suspicious I may have seen a case of chikungunya fever last weekend. The tests should be available when I get back to the hospital today. But we'll see it. I don't have any question about it. And that's a mosquito-borne infection. And you really don't want to get chikungunya fever. It's not going to kill you, but you're going to be pretty miserable if you get it. This all boils down to it's probably worthwhile trying to minimize mosquito bites. And we now know quite a bit how to minimize mosquito exposure. DEET has been the most powerful repellent out there, and a lot of people are frightened of DEET. They're worried it's a chemical, it's dangerous, it has potential for causing neurotoxicity. DEET is very effective as a repellent. It's the most effective repellent we have out there, but you don't have to put it on your skin. You can spray it on your cap. I spray it on my jacket when I'm going to be out picking berries or I'm out in the woods, and spray it on the external clothing.
And what if it's a child and you spray the hat and that child is, you know how children are always putting their hands in their mouth?
The risk is pretty low. Mm-hmm. But we have also very good repellents for children. Picardin is a repellent that became available in Europe. There's a couple of additional repellents that are now out there that are quite safe. Picardin you can put on the skin very safely. It's a natural product that's extracted as oil from plants. I would not buy the over-the-counter special oils. The bottom line is that Picardin and DEET are very effective. Picardin is very safe to put on the skin and provides a high level of protection for several hours.
Is there any danger that if all of us start spraying DEET and you know protecting ourselves in that way that we're going to come up with a DEET-resistant strain of the West Nile virus?
Well, you ask a very astute question, and that is, where they have sprayed into the environment, the best example is DDT. DDT was developed around World War II and was literally like a miracle chemical. They sprayed widely and they killed enormous numbers of mosquitoes. They greatly reduced spread of malaria during World War II and in the years that followed. But by the 1950s, it was becoming clear that DEET deposited in the fat of humans or animals, and you carried this probably forever, and there was good evidence that DDT was affecting the reproductive capacity of birds, and ultimately there was a moratorium, an international moratorium on the use of DDT. So I'm not an enthusiast for spraying chemicals in large quantities widely because resistance does occur very rapidly, and what they discovered was not only did it have a downside ecologically, but it was losing its effectiveness. It was selecting for strains of mosquitoes and other insects that were highly resistant. So the likelihood that our personal use of these chemicals to protect ourselves from insects such as ticks or mosquitoes will select for resistance is pretty minimal. When you spray it in the environment, it's a whole different ballgame.
I know there's a lot of products out there that make claims. I was just at a picnic last night where my husband, who's a physician, you know, was scoffing at the label on this Listerine wipes or some kind of chemical wipes for tables where it said prevents colds and flus. There are a lot of products out there that will say kills germs and, you know, how do you tell what really works and doesn't if it's just sort of a generic disinfectant?
Well, first of all, if a person is interested enough, they really want to get some good scientific information. We live, to me, in a very exciting time historically. There's never been more information available rapidly, good information. Unfortunately, there's a lot of misinformation out there as well. Google is an extraordinary resource for getting information, but you have to filter it. There's a lot of misinformation that's out on Google. If you're looking for good information on issues of public health importance, I think the CDC's website, cdc.gov, is almost unbeatable. It's extraordinary. They put a huge amount of effort to provide information for the lay public, really first-rate information. And if you're so inclined, you can go to their website. You can read everything that we as physicians in public health officials read. You can read the original material. You can read the original studies, the guidelines that are – they're all out there. They have one for the lay public, one for professionals, and the amount of information that they have is truly extraordinary. NIH has a website. FDA has a website. Our state health department has a website. You can put the name of the agency in Google and you'll immediately get the website. And those are very reliable sources of information. There's a lot of websites that purport to be experts, but they're transmitting a lot of misinformation, particularly websites that are opposing immunizations or vaccines. I think anybody who takes care of patients, and particularly children, every case of vaccine-preventable infection to me is a tragedy, and it didn't have to occur. And when a child is not immunized and they get diphtheria or they get pertussis and get very sick, may even develop secondary infection and die, or they develop polio, God forbid, getting polio when it's so easy to prevent with the vaccine, those are tragedies. And I think websites that are basically promulgating unproven information, in fact, they have no scientific information supporting their claims of the negative impacts of vaccines, are doing a great disservice to the public.
I know you've been very strong also as an advocate for safety within hospitals and just the importance of what can seem pretty simple, which is hand washing.
You raise a really important issue. I've devoted most of my research career to finding more effective ways to protect patients from infection in hospitals and the spread of resistant organisms. Many hospital organisms can be called emerging infectious diseases. Some of the very resistant germs we're now seeing, such as multi-drug resistant Acinetobacter, MRSA, vancomycin-resistant enterococcus. These organisms have only appeared in the last 10 to 15 years, and they're spreading very wildly. We're having strains of bacteria that are resistant to every drug in the antibiotic formulary, which is very scary. We're using experimental drugs to treat common infections with these very resistant organisms. Now, these are very concerning, but there's some good news here, and the good news is never have we had a deeper understanding of how infections are spread in hospitals, how they're acquired, who's at risk, what are the mechanisms by which spread occurs. And that's all occurred in my lifetime. There were no infection control programs in hospitals when I was a medical student. It only appeared, the whole movement started about 1970, 71, 72. And now every hospital in the country has a sophisticated full-time infection control program, have multiple professionals who are highly trained and work throughout the day trying to assure that there's high levels of compliance with proven control measures, looking for outbreaks and controlling spread. And rates of infection in hospitals have dropped strikingly in the last decade. It's been really striking. The evidence is very clear. If you go to the CDC website, there's an international program and there's a national program, huge amounts of data and millions of patients. The evidence is very clear. We've never been more effective at protecting patients from infection after surgery or if you have to be in an ICU. Is there risk? Absolutely. People are at greater risk all the time because our population is aging. We're doing more and more high-risk operations, which significantly extend life and improve the quality of life, but they have risk. But we understand that risk, and we're able to take additional protective measures now that greatly reduce the risk of secondary infection. So that's an important area of emerging infectious diseases.
I've noticed when I've been at the hospital, either as a patient or visiting patients, that there's a lot of variety. In other words, sometimes you're asked to put on a gown and a mask. Sometimes they'll do a survey and ask you, did the doctor that just visited you wear gloves? Lots of kind of trying different things. And I've noticed that there's more and more of those things that you wash your hands with as you're, you know, the hand sanitizer things right. As you enter and leave a room, which doctors now seem to routinely do. Do they make really that much of a difference?
All of the things that we do, the buzzword in modern-day medicine is evidence-based medicine. What we do to treat disease or to prevent disease should be based on science, not empiricism, not because the person who trained me said that's what we should do and the person who trained them told them that's what you should do. But there are studies. There are studies that show this is the best way to treat this disease, to diagnose this disease, or to prevent this disease. And when I went into medicine almost 50 years ago, went into the field, there were less than 10 randomized, double-blind randomized studies, entire medical literature. Today, in an average year, there's 5,000 to 10,000 published studies. And there have been hundreds of thousands of research studies in one lifetime. And so evidence-based medicine is a reality. That is what we do. We try to eliminate anything that is unproven and only do what we know with a pretty good level of certainty will prevent disease or be effective for treatment of disease. And in infectious control, that has certainly happened on a huge scale.
If you have just a few minutes left and you can speak to people in the way that, you know, a grandmother might say, eat your chicken soup and get plenty of rest and drink fluids and so on, if you could sort of speak generally to anyone listening who, first of all, wants to help with this global crisis, some of the tragedies abroad, or also just on a very sort of personal level wants to protect themselves and their loved ones, any kind of final words of advice you'd give us?
First of all, I think it's really important that we're all engaged in our health. I think a person would like to be informed. You'd like to know, what do I need to do to keep me healthy? And there's so much information out there, whether we're talking about if we're told we have hypertension or we're told we have hypercholesterolemia or we have diabetes, we should become informed about our illnesses, our diseases. And if we're informed, we're much better consumers of healthcare and we're aware of advances, we're aware of unproven therapies, and we're going to realize that what we're asked to do that's evidence-based is really important and it'll make a big difference in our continuing to be healthy or preventing further ravages of an illness. So I think we need to be informed, and I don't think you can be informed enough. And the good news, there's a lot of good information out there. The second thing is that I would emphasize again, vaccines have had a greater impact in prevention of infectious diseases over the last 100 years than any single measure that's ever been brought. Vaccines have had enormous – we've eliminated, for all intents and purposes, polio, measles. There's very, very little rubella. Rubella babies and congenital anomalies because the mother had rubella during pregnancy was very common when I was a medical student. The rubella vaccine came in about the time I was finishing my residency and has had a huge impact. And a baby having congenital anomalies because the mother had rubella is exceedingly rare now. Vaccines have had such a positive impact, and to deprive your children of the protection that they can have by – to deprive the society you live in of the added protection you can contribute by immunizing your children and yourself, we ought to really accept that vaccines are for the benefit of everybody. The third thing is just general hygiene. A major mode of spread of most germs is organisms on hands. Hands are a mechanism of spread of staph, of cold viruses, influenza viruses spread on hands. Lots and lots of organisms can be spread on hands. And so we teach our kids basic hand hygiene. You know, you cough into your elbow or you cough into a kerchief. You use hand hygiene. The waterless alcohol gels and hand rubs that are now widely available appear to work quite well. And they I don't think they should be considered a substitute for vigorous hand washing after you go to the bathroom or after you have grossly contaminated your hands. But just before you, after you've been shaking hands or been at a party, using a waterless alcohol hand rub would probably be a good idea. You'd rather not pick up MRSA that would result in a miserable boil, skin for your uncle, that would have to be treated a week or two later. So I think just basic hygiene, what we teach our children, we should be applying ourselves.
Well, thank you. And here's a fist bump to you and for being with us and helping to elucidate some of the scary infectious diseases that are out there and what we can do. Our guest has been Dennis Mackey, and I'm Emily Auerbach, hoping you can join me for the next hour of University of the Year.